Who's close with the crosswords? Anyone get close?
Sort of close-ish, but not quite as the crescendo of that.
Just to let you know that there are massages at the back, the way that they work is you go capture this wonderful person over there who's waving at you, his hands like a kind of dexterous horse that's powerful but also elegant, like an elk. They will rub your back, you will feel relaxed, and then you will transcend to a kind of form of humanity. But if you want to go to one of the massages, they're at the back over there. The roads are downstairs, please do go check them out. And the walk is happening in 15 minutes, 1:45, outside at the front, with John. Please go see him, he's an amazing historian and psychogeographer. All right, people are bustling in.
I'm going to need that. Can you please make sure you sit on the ground?
Yeah. On the right?
Yeah. You don't need it.
That
okay, beautiful people of Sunday Papers Live. Are you ready for your next speaker this side of the room? Are you ready for your speaker this side of the room? You guys may well represent the electorate here, bifurcated, split, you can't see each other. But the next speaker, we're delighted to have Danny Dorling from the University of Oxford. He is going to be speaking about the tempestuous political moment that we're living in. Keir Starmer was elected. And with a big majority, it was the kind of cliche was a mile wide and the way for thin. They're losing popularity, the media narrative would tell you to reform, but there's also a strong argument that they're leading most of their support to progressive parties like the Liberal Democrats. And the ascendant, the assailant that is climbing up the polls is Zach Polanski. So to unpack some of that complexity for these tempestuous political times, could we please give a very warm Sunday Papers welcome to Danny Dorling with some applause time in here.
Thank you very much for not going for a walk with the psychogeographer. I hope you don't regret it, because we're doing politics for about half an hour. Because I'm very interested in what you think. I'm going to tell you, first of all, what I think has been going on. I'm a geographer, so I'm interested in different parts of the world, different parts of this country, and whether we can get clues from data about what the future is going to be like. Because geography, you may not realise this if you did it at school or did it at university, geography is actually about the future. That's why we study climate change, that's why we study inequality, because we're interested in what's going to happen next. Now, the problem with the future is it's not very easy to work it out. So we do lots and lots of guesses. And we collect data. Now, I haven't got a screen, so I've got a little graph for you, which I'm going to hold up. I might even give, if you like a copy, come up here. And can you give one to the good people on there? And let's see, if we all share and hand it out, you'll all get to see it. Alternatively, if you Google Danny Dorling, D-O-R-L-I-N-G, I've got a website. Click on news and you'll find a copy of the graph. This is simply because I'm not making this up. That's why I'm telling you about it. It's on the back of the program. Oh, perfect. Even better. You can see we're well organised. Okay. So, British election study. Lovely. All right. You get to read lots of polls. People like to pick and choose their polls. You can find polls where the Greens are doing incredibly well, polls that can frighten you. I'm making assumptions because there's somebody doing massages at the back. I'm assuming that there aren't many reform folk in this room. But I don't want to upset anybody or hurt anybody's feelings. Yeah, everybody's welcome. I just would keep quiet for a bit if I were you. Safeguarding. Tell I work in a university. All right. There are lots of polls and lots of studies, but the British election study is the best. It tracks people. So it doesn't just ask them how they're going to vote in an election and do things like check whether they actually did vote. Because, you know, when you vote, it's crossed off on the electoral roll. We can get that data. We find lots of fascinating things, such as you're more likely to vote if you live near a polling station or can walk downhill on the way. Okay? There are loads and loads of things that influence what people do and what they believe. But this is data released in September about how the people they've been tracking in the UK said they voted at the general election and how their intentions have changed in just 1 year. Now, I look at graphs like this and I'm very sad. I tend to get excited by them. You know, we all get our kicks in different ways. Weird election graphs are one, because I don't think this has ever happened before in the UK. I'm going to try and not make this depressing. It doesn't have to be depressing. The main message is uncertainty. You get an awful lot of pundits telling you what's going to happen next. Whereas what the data in the last year shows us is a greater degree of volatility, uncertainty, fear, worry, angst going on in the electorate. So let's start with Labour. They won a huge number of MPs last year. Got slightly fewer votes than they did in 2019, but got many more MPs because the right-wing vote was split. Coming to power. Managed to lose half of their support in 12 months. This has never happened before. I cannot think of any period, at least since we've been measuring these things, in the UK, where a government has been formed and the party that has formed it has lost half its support. And it's not as if they took us into a war they weren't telling us about, or they've doubled our taxes or anything. They managed to lose our support not doing very much. But the key thing is, and apologies to Labour, they've done loads. There are 17 big things they've done early on. My favourite is getting women bishops into the House of Lords. That's a great claim to progressiveness. But what the graph tells you, most important thing, is that Labour hasn't lost its support because people say they're going to vote for reform. Right? The half of the Labour vote, which has disappeared to date, has gone mainly to the most honest answer, which is, I don't know what I'm going to vote next anymore. Right, the don't knows. The don't knows are the most important group in this country. They're the largest group, always. Right, not just people that abstain, but don't know. The Labour vote has mostly gone to don't know what I'm going to do, and then to the Liberals and to the Greens, and probably a little bit to your party when your party eventually becomes the party. It hasn't gone to the Conservatives, and it's hardly gone to reform at all. All those myths about red wall seats are myths. The red wall seats, the ones that switched to the Conservatives a couple of elections ago, are normally mostly in the north of England, but they tend to contain two or three very affluent areas. They might have names like Greater Grimsby, right, that make you think, oh, that must be poor, but the clue's in the word greater. It's on the edge. They're places to which often people who've come down and lived in London in their 30s and 40s, retire back up to with the cash that they've made here in their 60s and 70s. Right? The red wall seats tended to be slightly more affluent parts of the north. But that isn't what's happened to the Labour vote. If you like, it's a great, my favourite English word, it's a great disappointment. Right? If you're ever in deep, deep trouble in politics, somebody tells you that they're disappointed in you. And there's been a disappointment from the electorate in Labour. However, everything else has been turbulent as well. The Liberals did incredibly well at the last election. Got a huge number of MPs. Ed Davies, very popular, nice bloke. Have they capitalised on it? No. They've managed to lose as much support as they've gained in those 12 months. People don't know. They haven't got somewhere to go to. Now, the Greens did increase their support a little and have, since this graph was done, increased it a lot with Zach coming in. There were a couple of polls showing the Greens possibly ahead of Labour, even, in the opinion polls. But the Greens was starting from a very low base. They got about four MPs in the election, which is great. But for a European Green Party, this is very poor as a record. So the actual rise isn't that stunning, and it isn't that big enough yet to have an effect. Partly because the Green vote is so concentrated in a few places, geographically. Geography matters for British elections. Right? We don't have a democracy, in case you didn't notice, which is why we worry about things like getting women bishops into a House of Lords, right? Which just shouldn't be an issue. We have a weird first-past-the-post voting system, which means that most people do not get what they voted for, even in terms of their local political representation. And that's one reason why we have such a low turnout as compared to other countries. Another is that we're economically unequal, that we're a fractured country. Internationally, the more equal countries are over a series of elections, the higher the turnout tends to be, but also the better the politicians tend to be, and the better the result tends to be, and the better the trains actually run. Okay? We are getting onto reform. But before we get onto reform, let's do the Conservatives. Historic low. Incredible low at the last election. Because reform stood candidates in so many places. And people had a choice between voting for Conservatives or voting for reform. So the Conservatives did really, really badly at the last election. And then they've managed to lose half of that support in a year. Right? This is turmoil. We really don't know where we're at. The one thing I would say is I think it is almost impossible to have this degree of change for the next 12 months and the next 12 months. Unless we've completely lost our minds over what we think, it's probably going to settle down a little. And lastly, reform. How have reform got to a position where in some polls they have as much support as Labour and the Conservatives put together? How has that occurred? Well, the nice thing about the diagram is it shows you where they've come from. And they've largely come from that I don't know how I'm going to vote in the general election. It was people who didn't vote at the last general election, primarily, who say they would vote for reform now. That's where the swing in the support has come from, and then from the Conservative Party. So do not think that the rise of reform has anything to do with some working class movement from Labour to reform. It isn't that, at least not yet. There are people who'd like you to think that Nigel Farage and his friends, 80% of those MPs went to private schools, by the way, this is the most privileged political party we have, and that's before you even look at their funders and backers. They would like you to think that they're the honest voice of the working man and his wife, right? But, you know, so far in the data, in the polling, that is not there. We should be very frightened. We have not been in a position like this since the 1930s. In the 1930s, it was another charismatic rich man. His name was Oswald Mosley. He spent a large amount of his fortune trying to get himself and his friends elected. He became more popular. It was touch and go. It was touch and go which way this country was going to go. It's as bad as that. I'm not downplaying a sense of fear that it's worth having. I'm also not downplaying the interest there is from the United States of America in terms of what happens here. Right. You know what's happened in the United States of America. I want you to imagine that you're a tech billionaire. Most people in the United States of America have not done very well. 80% of people in the United States of America are living in areas that are in recession. The entire area has become poorer. But the GDP of the whole of America has gone up by about 3%, 3.9% in a year, because a small number of people, not even including people with a few million, the money's really, really concentrated to a few areas and a few people, a small number of people are still getting richer largely off what may be a tech bubble to do with AI. You may believe, we can talk about it if you want, I'm not an expert on AI, you may believe it's about to take over and so on. Alternatively, they may not get you all hooked on ChatGPT so much that you won't be paying them in future to tell you in the morning, should I come to the Sunday Papers Live or not? The highest use of ChatGPT is 18 to 24 year olds, and then it's 24 to 30. It's used for life advice, it's used to correct emails, it's what I should do. It's not just, please can you write my essay at university, or my dissertation, or my thesis. But it does kind of preoccupy us in universities at the moment. The tech billionaires. Five of the seven richest men in the world stood behind Donald Trump at his inauguration. They were absolutely elated. They had got what they wanted. They didn't know it was in the bag. They were concerned because they knew that this wasn't in the direct interest of the majority of Americans in the short term. But they only had to win a quarter of the vote, because in the United States, half of people don't vote. A lot of pushing, a lot of money, they got over the line, and they got their man in, and the people around him in, and the think tanks around them in. And then the question is, imagine you're one of these tech billionaires, you know the future. The future is terrible unless people do what you want. We need to expand. We need you all to have more babies right away, quickly. Well, some of you, not all of you. We have other planets that we need to populate. You know, there's a great future ahead for mankind, a particular group of mankind. I'm emphasizing the male nature of all this. And they're on a high. The next target geographically is not Mexico, it's not Canada, it's not Greenland, it's not really even Ukraine or the rare earth metals somewhere else, although they worry about those. The next place on the planet that matters most to very, very rich Americans is right here. It's London, it's England, it has been for a very long time. The most segregated immigrant group in this country, the ones who live parallel lives the most, are located as children around Hyde Park, and they were born in America. This is a kind of second city for Americans. Our banks are largely controlled by American banks. A huge amount of our infrastructure is owned by America. Culturally, historically, we have a special relationship. We have a bulwark in Europe for free thinking, for libertarian freedom. We're the place where the right-wing think tanks of Europe are mostly located, in Tufton Street and nearby, Lord North Street. We are the kind of hope for the mother continent, if you like. So I would worry about the interest from the United States in this country. But the electorate are all over the place. Starmer, Keir. He is currently polling at the lowest popularity, I think, of any Prime Minister ever. And, however, that is just a continuation of a rather beautiful graph. The graph begins with Tony Blair, I think. Now, it took Tony quite some time to become very unpopular. He was lucky, he was in for quite a long time. And then he left at his point of greatest unpopularity. Gordon Brown, it wasn't really his fault, it was a global financial crisis. He managed to become less popular than Blair in a short amount of time. But then David Cameron managed to become even less popular. Boris Johnson, less popular. Liz Truss managed to do it in less than 40 days. There was only one monthly poll when she was Prime Minister, but it had her popularity. The graph, beautiful. And when you thought, okay, there's no way anybody would become less popular than Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak, very pleasant, nice man, managed to become even less popular. So, in a way, it's not surprising that Starmer is so unpopular, because I think we're expressing something else. Other than our individual judgments about these people, we are not happy with the way things are going and the state in which they are going. We would like salvation. Salvation means very different things to different people, particularly by age, but also geographically in different places. But we've got a sense that things are wrong. We can measure this quantitatively. David Cameron, if you remember when he became Prime Minister, introduced a happiness index. And he said he was going to make everybody happier. And the Office of National Statistics have been running this. They release data every month on things like life satisfaction, anxiety, and so on. Now, the interesting thing is that social scientists haven't said much about this happiness index, because very strangely, people did actually get happier overall, which was a bit of a shock, because we had austerity, a divided society, we had Brexit, numerous crises, but the overall happiness level rose until it suddenly plummeted in the summer of 2019, when it became clear that Boris Johnson was going to begin to get his way. And the levels of anxiety peaked across the whole country to a new high, which was only slightly exceeded a few months later by the first wave of COVID-19. Johnson was such a shock, and Brexit, to the population of Britain, that when people were measured for anxiety, his proroguing of Parliament, his sacking the Conservative MPs, his getting what he wanted, caused upset amongst some people, enough people to cause the overall graph to rise. However, if you do things like compare the level of well-being or mental good health in the population, which was measured in the censuses of 2011 and 2021, you see something really interesting and initially strange. Now, one problem with my profession is we tend to make up explanations to data, right? So I'm not sure this is the answer. But overall, the level of good health in the population has risen at a time, this is in people's minds, at a time when our life expectancy actually fell, uniquely in Europe. It peaked in 2014 and then it was lower in 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018. We had deaths of despair, we had deaths due to austerity, we had rising suicides amongst the disabled. But people said that they thought their health was better than it had been, measured separately at two points in time. They weren't asked, has it got better? The people who said their health has got better were mainly older people, in their 70s and their 60s and a little bit in their 50s. And you've got to think about this, because most of you are younger than me. I was talking yesterday in Oxford, by the way, at a conference where almost everybody was older than me. I might tell you about that at the end. Most of you are younger than me. Why did people in their 50s a little bit, but particularly in their 60s, a bit older than me, and in their 70s, say that they were feeling better in the 2021 census as opposed to 2011? It isn't that they actually had better health. I mean, by 2021, 15% of all men over 90 had died of COVID and 10% of all women. And it isn't just that the fit were left, right? The objective health measures have got worse. What I think it helps to realise is that for a big group of the population, not in London, they got quite a lot of what they wanted. They got Brexit. Who do you think voted for Brexit? It was predominantly the old. The majority of people who voted for Brexit lived in the south of England, where a minority of the electorate lived. It's not a northern vote, it's Hampshire, put it simply. Right? And so Hampshire's got 1 million people, it really matters. The south is absolutely chock full of people. Right? There's been movement since the 70s southwards. But these folk, in many cases, there will be your parents or grandparents. these folk actually got what they voted for, not just in terms of elections, because they often voted Conservative, but in terms of Brexit, and they got what they were told that they wanted or that they were encouraged to be frightened of, increased attention about their biggest fears, things like immigration. They got a government that said it was going to fly people to Rwanda. And I think it's important to realise that for some people, that made them happy. Right? But when you look at the mental well-being scores, once you go below people's 50s to their 40s, you see that people in their 40s have got worse health than they had the equivalent age group in 2011. People in their 30s, much worse. People in their 20s, much worse. So we have a split demographically in the country between younger people feeling worse off, being materially worse off if you're paying rents around here, with enormous student debts, of course, which didn't exist at that level in 2011. Fees were still £3,000 a year. A sense of being ripped off massively, recording worse and worse and worse mental health at the same time, despite physically being in their 20s and 30s, which, believe me, I'm 57, right? If you're in your 20s and your 30s, you are at a huge advantage health-wise, but unhappy. And this is our electorate. I won't go into the geography, but it isn't a simple north-south divide. It's a divide, really, between connected and unconnected areas. I gave a couple of hundred public talks in the south of England after Brexit, all of them in areas that voted majority Leave, which most of the south of England did. The defining, if you wanted a really simple measure of does an area vote to leave, if I couldn't easily get back to Oxford or London on the train that night, it voted Leave. Right? That's just unconnected. There are some very, very simple geographies to what's going on. So, that's our situation. To stereotype, an older population, not all of them, but an older population, largely outside of the capital and the connected cities and the university cities, with a sense that things might be going in the right direction because they've been made afraid. I think there was a poll released yesterday or the day before showing that most people are not worried about immigration in their area, they're worried about it nationally, which means they've been told to be worried about it, right? But they've been effectively told to be worried about it. When I talk to people in the South about why they voted Leave for their grandchildren. They really did, because of the way things have changed. If you were young in the 1960s, or particularly 1970s, full employment. You could get a well-paid job by your early 20s. Half of you could get a mortgage by your mid-20s on a decent three-bed family house. Yeah? The schools were being sorted out. So for the first time in history, first time in almost any country in the world, your children could go to school with everybody else. They weren't going to be divided. They're all going to be given a chance over what they could do. You could have a job, you had a house, you had a future, you had optimism, and you had children. It's not very easy to have children if you're not optimistic about the future. And they saw all of this in their 20s, and then they watched their own children struggling, often renting in their 30s or 40s, not particularly happy. And then they look at their grandchildren and what's happening to them, and then somebody gives them a vote. And the vote is basically things can carry on as they are, or you can vote to change it. And they vote to change it. They were not voting selfishly in their late 60s and 70s, and in some cases their 80s, because they thought their own lives were going to get dramatically better before they died. And I think we need to understand that. They thought or have been persuaded that the way in which they could make the future better for the people they cared about most, which was their family, because they've been told there was no such thing as society by the early 80s, for their family, you need to change things in this way, and then we'll get the bright sunlit uplands in the future. And again, this isn't just a story for one group. George Osborne in 2015 promised that if we followed his economic plan, then by the year 2030, we would be the richest large country in GDP per capita in the world. Right, that was the promise George Osborne made. The promise was repeated by Boris Johnson before he was kicked out of office. Just follow me and we'll become one of the richest in the world. Keir Starmer did a version of it. I think it was highest growth of the G7. Right, this constant promise of we won't just make life okay, make things reasonable. The long-term aim is to make Britain great again. And if you persuade the population that that is a laudable aim, and they see things not going in that direction at all, it's easy, I think, to get people riled up. So what do I think is going to happen? And I'm going to open it up for questions in a minute, because you'll get bored of hearing my voice. I think it's very useful that Donald Trump has become president for the second time in the USA. I think it's concentrating minds in many parts of the world, and in many parts of the world, we're getting voting that wasn't predicted. Even in India, Modi didn't do as well in the last election as his party had expected, Modi being a somewhat like Donald Trump. The Canadian election was a rejection of Trump. The election that's just occurred in the Netherlands was heralded as almost like the end of the fascists, which it probably won't be, but it's, you know, if you're feeling down, read up on some of the speeches that were made in the Netherlands in last week. Or the election in Poland a little bit earlier. The electorate can now look and see what the reality is if you let these people into power. If they look. And it all depends where you're getting your information from. Through which filter you're being told what's going on. How interested are you in that? I've got to do one plug for a book. I don't think it's here, so I'm not actually making money for myself. But the book I published this year is called The Next Crisis. And it's done okay, because it has a bright yellow cover and it says Next Crisis on it. And it doesn't really matter what you put inside the book if you do that, it turns out. People are very fearful of crises. I look at data again in that, and this is the context we're thinking about this. We have had a heightened state of crisis since the 1960s. And you can measure it in various ways. The simplest ways are just how often is the word crisis used. And we didn't use the word crisis much in the 1930s. It went up a little bit, gratifyingly, otherwise I get worried. But only a little bit in the 1930s. Very, very underused before then. Because crises weren't really crises, because they were normal. We had endless pandemics, epidemics in the past. We have fewer now. We had endless wars in the past. We have fewer now. But in the 60s, the use of the word rose, particularly with the Cuban Missile Crisis. But I think also, I think optimistically, because enough of us had enough time to sit and think and worry and look around. And we looked at things that weren't working in the world. We looked outside of our own communities. We've been allowed to stay on at school to 18. Some of us have been allowed to go to university. We had news from abroad, and it looked like crises. The use of the word crisis was higher again in the 70s, higher again in the 80s, higher in the 90s. The idea that there's a modern, current, recent polycrisis doesn't fit the data on crisis. The data I use in that book ends in 2019. So I'm absolutely certain that the next time we measure the use of the word crisis, given what happened in early 2020 globally, it's going to go off the scale again. We are scared about the future. We don't look forward in hope to the future. We worry about all kinds of things. If you are affluent, your number one crisis may be the climate crisis. It is absolutely there. But most of the world's middle class, the better off people in the world, don't worry about the climate crisis as the top one. They worry about poverty, inequality, and cost of living. Those three put together actually rank, two of them rank one and two. And they're roughly the same thing. Most middle class people in the world worry about getting by. The second thing that most people worry about, when they tick what do you worry about, given a list of 18, the second thing is unemployment. And these are better off people. These are my students at university, at the University of Oxford. Right? They worry about unemployment now, about not getting a job, not being wanted, not being needed. When I went to university, I went to Newcastle, didn't matter where I went. Less than one in 10 of us went to university. We were guaranteed for life. The only question is, what job are you going to have? Not, are you going to have a job? And I went after 3 million young people had become unemployed in the 80s. We still didn't worry because we knew we were safe. That's no longer the case. This fear has stretched across society. The majority of my colleagues in universities in Britain are now worried about unemployment because 41% of universities are in deficit, and that's rising. And then, I've got to cheer you up in a minute on this. And then we sing song, come by yard, we should do. It is Sunday. And then people worry about crime, they worry about violence, despite the fact, and here's the good news, of course, the chances of violence are extremely low, but it's easy to get people worried about it. Right? The most dangerous thing you're going to do today is cross the road on the way home. Right? If you're having any fears about violence in this country or any other, right, crossing the road on the way home, even in London, even with 20 mile an hour limits, right, is still far more dangerous than anything else you're going to do. But that personal fear of safety, violence, and in many cases war, in those countries that are either at war or surrounding war, is high. Despite the fact that the number of deaths in wars has gone down greatly since the 50s and 60s and 70s. It's risen slightly in the last 16 years. It is at a historic low and unlikely to affect anybody directly in this room. And then after that, people worry most about public services, more than the climate change. They worry about the schools, they worry about the hospitals, they worry about the housing, they worry about political corruption when asked. This differs between countries. I'm basing this data on Ipsos Mori, but also on the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, which fortunately did a very similar survey in China. And interestingly, in China, the biggest worry is healthcare, which partly shows that the Chinese government have managed to not get people to worry about inequality and cost of living, despite the fact China is as economically unequal as the USA, but everybody's better off than their grandparents. They've managed to not get people worried about unemployment because the government is going to try to ensure that there is a job for you, even though Chinese PhD students worry about unemployment in China because growth is only 6%. They've managed to not get people worried about war because China tries very hard not to go to war. We may not have noticed, but just add it up. But in an ageing society, healthcare is a worry. Everybody always has a worry. And then only beneath those for the world's middle class comes climate change. We are the country that worries more about climate change than anywhere else in the world. Only 9% of us are climate sceptics. Because of a political agreement that may be breaking down now, but an agreement between the parties and in the media not to put forward people telling you it's not getting hotter. So, and this is good news, but it also shows you that we can all be manipulated. Because we wouldn't be the country that's least climate sceptical in the world had it not been for our politicians making an agreement and our media making an agreement. So to wrap up on this, we have huge uncertainty in what's going to happen in the next 3 years. Caerphilly, if you saw that by-election, was absolutely fascinating. The main lesson I take from Caerphilly, where Plaid beat Reform, was it would be really helpful if the party that I'm still a member of, Labour, were not to put up posters explaining that they were the only one that could win, which they did in Caerphilly. That wouldn't be helpful in places like that in the future. I have to be careful because I'd like to remain a member of that party, which is quite hard to do if you speak your mind at times. You can look for lots of signs of hope. You can look for the signs of hope in the political beliefs of young people. The worry is that they don't vote. And the question is, what will it take to get the vote out from the young? And it could well be bigotry from the old being expressed in such certain times that you begin to think, I'm going to do it, I've got to vote, I've got to get myself registered to vote because the alternative is that bad. Unfortunately, and I will wrap up for questions, unfortunately this may well be the belief of the people who are advising Keir Starmer at the moment. They may have a belief that the higher the support for reform goes, the more likely people are to hold their nose and vote Labour, even if the two-child policy remains, even if Thames Water remains a private company, even if nothing much is done to make your lives better. And that, I think, is a dangerous future. Thank you very much for letting me rant at you on a Sunday afternoon. Any questions while I've got a little bit of time, please ask them. Sir, at the back.
We're
going to pass the mic over.
Thank you. What comparisons or otherwise do you see between the rise of reform and the apparent collapse of the Tories with the rise of the Labour Party and the collapse of the Liberals in the 1920s?
What comparisons do I see between the collapse of the Liberal Party in the 1920s and the rise of Labour, and whether we're seeing a similar thing going on now? My great-grandfather was a Liberal agent in the 1920s. And my grandfather joined Labour. Couldn't get back in 1945 from Berlin in time to stand. Otherwise, history could have been different. So this switch is part of my family history. I think they're very different. The Liberals are really interesting in Britain. Every European country has a Liberal Party, quite similar to our Liberal Party. You know, free economics, quite right-wing on economics, but left-wing socially. The fascinating thing about our Liberal Party is how, well, when you actually get PR, Liberal parties in the mainland tend to do very badly. You only get about 1% of the vote. Whereas ours does quite well out of only being in government once in a coalition. So I think it's a strange party in a way that it survives in Britain, whereas in the rest of Europe there isn't this particular strange, you know, I want to get rich, I want low taxes, but I want to be nice to people as well party. The Conservative Party cannot carry on forever. Yes. Just because it was the most successful party in world history, it can't carry on forever. But it's quite possible that the two merge, that the personal ambitions of those reform MPs at the top of the reform are such that if they're guaranteed cabinet minister posts, they might agree to a merger. In that weekend when the coalition talks took place in, if I get it right, 2010, Gus O'Donnell shouldn't have just given them a weekend to do it. It was all the millionaire Liberals who became cabinet ministers, and Sarah Tever. Sarah Tever was lovely and ended up resigning in tears. So don't underestimate personal ambition over what may happen. The rumours I hear at the moment are how many potential Conservative candidates, and maybe even sitting Conservative MPs, are currently looking for other jobs. You know, I think a much better measure than spread betting would be to actually track, you know, what are these people doing, because this is their future.
Danny, I might just jump in because we're running out of time. Okay. To get a few more questions, if that's all right, if there are any more. And we'll take two at a time. There's going to go down there. Is there anyone else who would have a question? We'll take them at the same time. Let's just open that.
This is a brief one, actually. I know you mentioned Ipsos Mori. I'm just wondering, because my ignorance, are there any other credible survey sites to look at? Because you were mentioning facts and statistics from that primarily.
Yeah. Ipsos Mori for the World Value Survey. I think Ipsos are one of the best, most neutral pollers, but there's YouGov as well. And in the next crisis, I particularly look at YouGov's polling of conspiracy theories, which is partly slightly funny. It's partly funny because one of the conspiracy theories that they tested turned out to be true before their survey reported, which was Russian interference in the American election. But Ipsos Mori, I like the most. At Davos every year, the world's risk managers meet and they forecast what's going to go wrong in the year ahead. So I look at a number of things. But I most like the Ipsos one because it's people's actually answering what is it presented with a series of things that worries you the most.
Do we have any final questions? Oh, we've got one here. If we have two, we'll take them both very quickly.
My one's pretty quick. I was just wondering, at the end you said there was an agreement that they're not going to like promote any climate deniers. Is that an agreement or is that just like an accepted practice because they don't want to put a nut job in Parliament?
I'll just take one on the back at the same time.
Thank you. Yeah, just any comments on the Mamdani Polanski sort of happenings? And just interested to hear your take.
On the Polanski happenings and that, yeah. Why did we get the agreement about climate change? The conservative story is that Margaret Thatcher was a scientist and she knew about the ozone hole. But the ozone hole was very, very simple. You had to stop releasing the CFCs and do that. I think patrician, nice old Attorneys like David Cameron kind of got it and had some morals. And at a time when they could have gone differently, they stuck with it and did that. At the moment, reform really want to say it's these climate change people that are the reason why you can't heat your house and you can't fill your car with petrol. And they're going to go for that big time over the next couple of years. And possibly also the soft power of science in Britain. You know, our universities are politically powerful in culture. My university, just to the west of London, basically, if you don't go to it, you're not going to become Prime Minister. Okay? And the culture, and I'm in the Department of Geography and Environmental Science, we have 100 climate change scientists, we have Mr. 1.5 degrees from Paris, has the offices not too far down from me. So the connections between climate science, scientists, and politics are close. But currently, Kevin Badenoch is flirting with moving the targets and implying it's not that important, and reform are going to go all out for that. And it's being watered down by some in Labour as well. Ed Miliband's sitting there desperately trying to keep it up. Polanski's up Polanski, and the rise. I think it's really interesting that the Greens have gone in this direction and gone left. They're not all entirely happy with it. There are some unhappy Greens about what's happened. It's an obvious space. It's helped greatly by your party not forming themselves in a way they might have done faster. It's you know, 800,000 people were willing to join a new political party, which failed to work out its database properly and argued internally. And I think that coming in at that time is a large reason why the Greens have seen such a growth in membership, because in like 3,000 people in Bristol. It's too much a cult of one person, is my worry, and it's not that hard to knock him down over. He used to be a Liberal. You know, he doesn't have a CV like Caroline Lucas. So I wouldn't put all your hopes in the Greens, but in certain cities, particularly university cities, it is quite likely that they can get the number of MPs up from 4 to 8 to 12, and that's what a normal, decent European country should have. So I'm optimistic on that, but the big, big fight is for Labour to get some soul, not to try to ape reform, to be anti-migrant, to be sceptical about the pace of climate change, but to come out, call them racists, and call it a fight, and say, when all those flags were put up across Britain, how many of them were put up by people who were paid to put them up? Because they're far too high and they're far too neat.
Thank you so much. Good note to end on. Sammy Dolan.